Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. We're so excited for this conversation. It's really been a long time coming. And I'm happy to, you know, that it's finally happening because I think that it's been long overdue. Hello, Alma.
Hi, I am so excited for today's conversation. I think it is a long time coming, and I'm really just so keen to talk about a book that I think resonated so deeply with so many of us just across the country and the world.
And I think in order, before we introduce our guest today, I wanted to read the blurb by one of the people you've given it a shout out. No, I'm not going to read myself.
Oh my gosh, thank you. Please do not.
With Khamer, Jamil Afkhan has gifted us an exquisitely crafted, groundbreaking memoir destined to change and save lives. Khalid, Muslim and queer, Jit Khan's coming of age story sketches the process of claiming an autonomous, fully articulated self, actualized self, as he's grappling with classism, colorism and homophobia in a middle-class Cape Town colored community where appearance are everything. His turbulent journey includes navigating his father's alcoholism and the accompanying stigma that clings to the family, encapsulated with the Slevato slums, and the destruction of his father's addiction wreaks on the entire family, as well as the young boy's sense of security in the world. He unstatedly sketches the constant undertow of homophobia, which threatens to entrench a sense of estrangement from his family and faith. Khan renders this excruciating journey into adulthood with elegance, moving prose, skillfully demonstrating the soul-destroying effects of intersecting oppressions, yet he leaves the reader with a sense of hope and redemption. Unsparing and morally uncompromising, but full of compassion and empathy for the chief agents of his oppressor, Khan succeeds in poignantly mapping his quest for freedom, but that is ultimately revolutionary. He has documented an important spirit-healing story, a beautiful undoing of some of the unspeakable violence of Black queer erasure from history. Professor Barbara Boswell, Associate Professor of English at UCT and author of Grace, a Novel. And I just think we can go home. I think Barbara encapsulates, like, just everything, right? Just everything, right? And I really like that, you know, she did this blurb in the way that she did, because it gives the reader so much, but also makes the reader want to know more. So with that, we'd like to welcome Jamil Afkhan, author of Khamer, The Makings of Avato Slums. Born in Cape Town, Jamil Afkhan is a researcher, author, columnist, and poet. His research focuses on the politics of creolization and colored identities in South Africa, while exploring the interrelations of power in race, ethnicity, gender, identity, and sexuality. He's a doctoral candidate in critical diversity studies and lives in Joburg. Welcome, Jamil.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here.
We're so excited to have this conversation with you. I think I read it before it was published, and I remember saying to the Tlokonolo, we need to get Jamil onto the Cheeky Natives, because what the hell? Like, I can relate to so much of the stuff that he's written about. And I think that the question really for me, before we even get into the substance of the book, is to speak about the act of actually writing a memoir. Memoirs are really personal, but memoirs are also brave, because they ask us to go back into the depths of our memory and to recollect some of the most painful things that we may have experienced and to write honestly about them. So I want to know why you chose to write a memoir at such a young age, right? Because there's a thing also about the age at which people choose to write memoirs, but also the impact of writing so honestly about your life.
Yeah. You know, I thought about it in terms of age. And I think that there's something to be said for chronological age and time, and just sort of an experience of life. I think there are people, not always of their own choosing, as was my, in my case, who experience a lifetime's worth of things in a very short space of time, and have a lot could possibly have a lot more to say, and maybe perhaps more interesting things to say at the age of 30 about a life lived than somebody might find themselves being able to say at 50. So for me, I knew that it was something that would be a question, but I knew that at the age of 30, there was already a lot to say. And of course, I think when I looked at the ways in which other memoir writers have handled their stories, even though she was already of quite a substantial age when she started writing a memoir, Maya Angelou also wrote installments of a life. You know what I mean? So it's not necessarily to say that you have to have the whole story before you can start writing it. And so for me, that was an important time to tell the story. And also just to say that the experiences that I write about before I started writing about it, I thought of them as quite insular experiences because of the insularity of the community that I existed in. But it's actually been really, really surprising, but also heartwarming to hear how people who never found themselves in, you know, the same context as I and never necessarily dealt with exactly the same things as I still found resonance in it. And I think that speaks to, I don't want to say the universality of a South African experience, but I think it speaks to rather the consequences of existing in South African society as a marginalized person.
I mean, it's really interesting to think about Khame, right? So in many ways, I think that your book in itself is a tool to fight against particular things, right? So you think about fighting against particular narratives, fighting against particular erasures of history. And I'm really interested to find out about like the use of language, right? And how language in many instances is used as a reclamation, but also as a form of naming things, right? So we think about the title of your book, right? Khamer. Can you talk to us a little bit about like, why you chose the book, The Makings of a Vital Slums? Like, can you tell us more about that?
I'm going to ask you to just repeat the last part of what you said, that I lost your sound.
Okay, can you hear me now clearly?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so I was talking about the idea of language used as a tool of reclaiming, but also as a tool of rejection, right? And how in many ways, one, to talk about the title of your book, Khamer, but also to talk about the subtitle of your book, which is The Makings of a Vital Slums, and how those two things sort of tie together and how they were what you chose in order to introduce us to your work.
Yeah, the title was an interesting journey. It was an interesting conversation between me and my publisher. First of all, the title, Khamer, and as people read the book, they will discover that Khamer is an Arabic word for what is broadly known as intoxicants. People generally use it to refer to alcohol specifically. And I knew that it would be sort of a, you know, you have to do a double take when you see the word and then you want to be like, how do I say this? And that was, there was a question around, you know, do you want to make people work that hard? But I thought for me, the way in which I juxtaposed Khamer, which is an Arabic word, which is the language in which Islam is practiced across the world, and then to juxtapose it with the word Vata Slums, which is a Cape Town colloquialism, which basically means diluted Muslim. I think there was a way in which I, as a person and at the time as a Muslim person, because of the life that my father created for us, I was locked out. I was locked out of Islam in many ways. And in some ways by, you know, by the larger Muslim community. In some ways, I sort of excluded myself because it was just easier to do that. And so to use that term, khamr, to lay claim to a history, to lay claim to a community, and to also just assert that it is also my word to use, despite the fact that I had been locked out, and also use it kind of ironically in juxtaposition with Vata slums, which basically derides my standing as a Muslim. It was very deliberate, and it was a political decision to say, we don't get to own words and things and the power of those things to wield over other people, and so further entrench their shame and marginalization. So the decision to do that for me was really about that. It was about saying, this word has been wielded over me as a weapon all my life, and with the telling of this story, it stops here. So that was generally where that kind of came from.
I want to speak a little bit about the complexities of people that you write about, right? So there is a particular scene in the book where you are treated with kindness by someone that we wouldn't expect to treat you with kindness, you know. And I'm referring to the scene where your father, where you are outed by somebody, and there is this conversation that takes place between you and your parents. And then you refer to your grandfather saying that you're never too bad to be good, but you're also never too good to be bad. But I think that moment is an example of the complexity with which you write people and their contradictions, right? That nobody's ever one thing. So that there are people who in their entire selves are complex and are walking contradictions. Is that not what it means to be human? And so I want to talk a little bit about what it means to have been able to write this memoir and to see people in their entire complexity, and all of the contradictions that they espouse, and what that's meant for your relationships with people moving forward.
So I think, you know, I coming back to the first question, you know, about timing, a big part of why I wrote the book when I did was because I had resolved a lot of anger. And in having resolved that anger, I knew that I could then tell a story without sensationalizing the lives of the people featured in the story. So I never wanted to, at least at the time that I wrote the book, because I had resolved the anger, I didn't want to write people as, I don't know, like tabloid fodder kind of thing. Because yes, as much as what people did, you know, did and said things that were harmful, I think about what that means for a journey of someone like me, for example, which I talk about in the book, who has resolved to undertake, you know, a journey of unlearning and self-improvement. And I wonder about, if I'm to live fully as a human being with access to all the mistakes and missteps that human beings are prone to, if I were to be written about one day or recalled one day, and those mistakes that I had made become the sum total of the legacy that I had left, then what is the journey of what is the work? What does it mean? Why would we do it? And so if I think about the kind of I want to say understanding that I would hope to enjoy amongst people, then I couldn't possibly have written a story that didn't extend that understanding to other people, even though I did feel that they have done harmful things. And I say, it is not okay to be harmful. It is not okay to cause other people pain. But And those people must account for it. You know, some can't account for it anymore. They're not here. But accountability must be administered. But I understand, because I just spoke about the consequences of living as a marginalized person in a place like South Africa. I understand how people like that come to be. And I think it's a much more important and interesting conversation to talk about the ways in which people come to be and cause the harm that they do cause, than to start at the end point, which says, well, you've caused this harm and therefore there's nothing more to say about you. And it's also the contradictions you talk about. It's a very contradictory thing for me to think about, for example, my father. And of course, I'm sure we all know, I didn't tell each and every last detail of my life in this book. There's a lot more that people might even be more shocked about. But the contradiction of thinking about someone like my father, who was harmful in many ways, but then looking at myself and thinking, you know, there are these qualities that I have or these behaviors that I've learned that I really enjoy and I think really helpful. And I think that they are quite useful and nurturing to the people around me. And then to recognize that, oh, I learned that from my father. So it's a very difficult thing to hold somebody in absolute contempt or absolute reverence within boundaries, of course, but I didn't want to do that because I don't think it's realistic.
I mean, connected to that is the idea of like grieving complicated relationships, right? And I think that you've touched on it a little bit in your response, but I want to speak a little bit about that, about the idea of how, like, you know, this person, you didn't have a really great relationship with when they're alive, right? And then they pass away. And it makes your grief a little bit complicated because you're angry and you're just like, well, I'm not glad, but like, you know, this person is no longer causing harm, but this person is also a part of my life and they are gone. So they're no longer going to be there. And I want to talk about that, you know, grieving complex relationships. I think that often society doesn't give us the space to grieve in the way that we want to. They often say, don't speak ill of the dead. No, this person did the best that they could. But that in many ways is invalidating your experience and how your life has been impacted by this person in their absence. So to think about that, like, how was it for you to write about your father now that he's passed, but to also contend with the fact that, like, it wasn't always good. Also, it wasn't always bad. And now I need to sort of navigate this by saying, I recognize the good, but the good cannot overshadow the bad.
Yeah, yeah. I think for me, the thing with my father and having written the book after he passed is that in many ways, what I think I was trying to do was also for myself, sketch some possibilities for what, not an ideal relationship, but a better relationship could have been. And I think personally, I will always try and create that possibility for myself, because when I look at my father in retrospect, not being in the situation anymore, not being in the firing line anymore, I see things a little bit differently. Also now having lived a little bit and having seen a little bit of what life puts one through, I understand certain things differently and better in many ways. So for me, writing the book and subsequently now having, you know, numerous conversations thereafter answering questions like this makes me realize that the complexity, and I claim that very selfishly for myself, that I am entitled to, for as long as I need to or want to, explore and write into reality for myself the possibilities of a relationship that could have been. And yes, this is with a harmful person, and the harm is documented. But there are ways. I think with me, also when my dad died, I didn't feel much, to be honest. I wasn't devastated. I wasn't sad. There was even a sense of relief. Because like I said, now this person is no longer here causing harm. But as time went by, I realized there were certain things that I wish I still had the chance to cultivate and to nurture. And also, mind you, as my dad got older, he softened, you know. And so I think, you know, there was a level of softening that I, or softness that I would have been able to experience had he lived longer. But this is my way. This is my way of living with and exploring those possibilities. And I think that's a completely and utterly valid thing, especially in the context of me saying I still acknowledge the harm and I don't excuse it nor discount it.
I think that, you know, just to pick up on that last point about writing into possibility or writing into reality different possibilities that may have been. For me, it was also something that came up in the book was the reimagining of family, right? And chosen family, because you'd had this harmful experience of family, but we see you in the book as a queer person being able to have chosen family, right? And so reimagine what familial dynamics may have looked like in that sense, that reimagining. So I wanted to speak a little bit more about that, right? About what it's meant for your own reimagined family to have been able to have chosen family.
Yeah, you know, I often say this. A lot of us are raised to believe that, you know, this concept of family and family in the sense that you are related by blood, as they say, to somebody is just, it's non-negotiable. It's unchangeable. It's immovable. It is just, that's how it will always be. And as I got older and through the experiences I write about in the book, and of course, those experiences did not end at the book, there is still a kind of familial inheritance of abuse and discord that permeates my life. But I often say, yes, we might be related, but we first and foremost are still people. And sometimes we're not such great people. And I don't have to suffer the consequences of your lack of greatness as a person. I don't have to put myself in harm's way with you. So for me, it's been very, very deliberate to create communities which really are families, especially queer families. It's been very important for me to do that, to also reclaim a sense of agency in this process, because I think that concept that I just introduced now, that we often get met with as children, is that family is non-negotiable. It is a complete and utter disposition of agency. You don't have choices in those instances, and I've rejected that completely. I have love for certain people, and that's probably a consequence of, if I'm being honest, familiarity. I've known you for so long, and I've also been socialized to feel certain things about you and interact with you in certain ways. And I'm not going to try and like actively undo that. But I think it's very important, not only for queer people, but for everyone, to understand that we are fully entitled to move away from harmful family structures completely, without explanation, without having to justify the reasons for it. If you experience harm and abuse, that is an experience that should be recognized. And you are fully entitled to then go on and create families of your own choosing. And I would highly recommend it. It's been absolutely imperative for my well-being, for my self-esteem, for my mental health. I think it's it's important to realize that things, concepts like family are not some pre-existing, divinely ordained community that one has to trudge along with until your dying day. So very important for me to reimagine what family can look like and then actually, yeah, have the courage, because it does take courage, to execute it. But, you know, people often ask me like, oh, but how do you do it? What do you say? I don't know. I'm scared. I'm this. I can't explain your fear away, and I can't really give you all that much in the way of explanation for how to do it. But it really is one of those things that when it's time for you to do it, you just have to do it. And when you found those people who welcome you into their lives as family, accept the good and take the opportunities to make new of things that really are not working.
I mean, it's really interesting because in many ways, like, I love how beautifully this conversation is turning out. Just because in thinking about like the reimagining and repurposing of family, there's also this conversation about like the reimagining of love and stepping away from love, which is something that you alluded to just earlier. But thinking about like, you know, Bell Hooks often speaks about abuse and love cannot live together, right? Abuse negates love. But we think about the societies in which we've grown in and how we've been socialized to believe in many instances that when your parent used to beat you, they love you. And so for many of us, I think that it's one of two things. It's either we abhor the idea of like abusing the people that you love. So we're complete opposite. We try our best in all instances to not be abusive to the people that we purport to love. But then there is the other extreme, that we start believing that love can only exist in an abusive setting. So it impacts the way we have future platonic and romantic relationships. So when people are nice to us, we can't understand why they're nice to us, because we are not worthy of niceties and kindness and respect, right? And we're just worthy of people swearing at us and beating us. And, you know, there's even this like sort of conversation that we often have on social media about like, what? Your husband doesn't beat you? Your boyfriend doesn't beat you? Does he not love you? So I wanted to speak a little bit about that, because I think that's something that is quite a prevalent theme in the book, the idea that like, yes, we are complicated people, right? But let us never forget that like abuse can never exist in a love setting. So you don't necessarily harm the people that you love. And so I want to speak about that, about like in writing about it, how has that shaped, you know, your outlook on platonic and romantic relationships?
Yeah. So in my life, the forms of abuse that have reigned supreme, if you will, have been emotional, psychological, and verbal. And I will say this, though, interestingly, in my family, when you know, things happened that turned abusive in those ways that I mentioned, the response afterwards or the justification afterwards wasn't necessarily that I said that because I love you. It was I said it because I'm angry, or I was angry. And that's also made me, it put me throughout my life in constant interrogation with this concept of anger and how suddenly how it then becomes a justification for anything, really. You know, when I am angry, I can do anything and everything that I deem necessary to soothe this anger. And if you are then a casualty of it, then, oh, well, you'll get over it, kind of thing. But what I have done with that is, I mean, I've said it to people in my life. I've said, I understand that this is how you deal with things and that you feel that this is justified, but I am no longer participating in this. I am not no longer available for to be an outlet onto which you bleed your anger. And it's been useful in shaping and managing those relationships. But on the flip side, it's also taught me to be very intentional about how I want to create love and how I want to shape love in my life. And so for me, a direct consequence of interrogating the abuse that I have been through and then sort of refusing to participate has been understanding for me, love is kindness and love is softness. Even down to, you know, when I talk about softness, I'm not even necessarily talking about some kind of metaphorical softness. Even down to the tone of voice that we use with each other, especially when we are angry, because I don't discount the value of anger. It's a valid emotion. It can be and must be expressed. But there are ways in which one can use anger and express anger that doesn't harm other people. So for me, it's been kindness in thought and deed under such circumstances of anger. It's been tone of voice. It's been inquiry instead of accusation. I think that's been a very important thing for me is, and I haven't always got it right, but I try. But to inquire about what's going on with the other person, inquire about what they are thinking when they say certain things, inquire even with regards to yourself as to why you take things the way you do when another person is saying to you, but that's not what I said. That's not what I meant. That's why do you always suspect me of, you know, those kinds of things. So inquiry instead of accusation, definitely a big part of practicing love, especially in contexts of conflict. But yes, I do agree that the two cannot coexist. And I think when I look back on this concept of love, and I wrote about it in the book, but I said that when I think about the ways in which we've been socialized to understand love, that love that's being spoken about there, actually, it does harm us. It does maim us. And in its final form, it kills us. So for that reason, we have to divest from that idea of love and understand that it was never love to begin with.
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
So I think that what you said is just so powerful, right? About divesting from those spaces. But I also am interested in the locality or the positioning of the book, right? So the physical location of the book, but also as it relates to the social location, right? So we watch that even in communities that are marginalized themselves, there's a stratification and there's an oppression that they themselves are capable of exerting. And this oppression also then feeds into the anti-blackness that we see in the book. So this book is physically set in a place that, of course, has quite a strong relation to racism and anti-blackness. But then you also see it in the communities have this anti-blackness recreated. And so for me, the positioning and the location of this book is very interesting, and I'm hoping that you can talk a little bit more to that.
Yeah, you know, our communities historically, and not that much has changed, you know. Of course, I haven't been back to my hometown, and when I say hometown, not the larger Cape Town, but like my particular community in, gosh, probably maybe 10 years. But I know that it still looks the way it does. And so these communities historically were deliberately designed to have, the community itself was constructed as a result of inequality. On top of that, there was a deliberate effort to create inequality within that inequality. And so I think when I look back on it, as with most things, the things like anti-blackness and racism in such communities was about trying to claim a superiority that would entitle one to more resources, because that is the consequence of inequality, and it's the consequence of deprivation is that one will always clamor for trying to prove that one is more deserving, more worthy. And in a context like South Africa, whereby historically race and ethnicity was very much interlinked with an economic social structure, you can see how such behaviors are inspired by attempts at getting out, getting better, getting more. And so I look at the decision that I made to extricate those dynamics, and think that it was an important contribution to make, because even within that, again, it was not just enough to say, well, there was anti-blackness and it was wrong, and you know, everybody must get on the chopping block for being anti-black. I wanted to use, again, location. And again, so there's this community in the larger Cape Town that is tethered to an idea of a Cape Town that appears on a brochure. And that Cape Town is the superstructure that creates, or a part of the superstructure that creates this community that is so embattled with its own inequality. Yeah. And so I think it was an important decision to show how there are reasons why things look the way they do. There are reasons why people behave the way they do. And these are the consequences, once again, of an extremely unequal society. And that, for me, was the golden thread that I wanted to run through the book with regards to location, locality, positionality, you know, all those kinds of things that come through in the book. The point that I want to come down to every time is that these are the consequences of extreme inequality. And this is the harm that it causes over and over and over again. And without resolving that inequality, none of these things will ever go away.
Amen. I feel like you're preaching, so I just had to say amen.
Because I think
in many ways, what I think the book does on a more academic level is to make us think more deeply about like structures, right? More deeply about the idea of where we are in the world and what that means for us wherever we are in the world. But I think also a golden thread that takes out in the book is this journey of becoming and navigating this journey of becoming. And I want you to speak a little bit about that, because, you know, we meet a young Jamil who tells us the story of how, you know, just living in this family situation and trying to find meaning in this family situation, and then who grows up to know from a very young age that they are different, and that their difference is dangerous. So they tone themselves down. They do certain things in order to not stick out because they know for a fact that that danger, that is dangerous sticking out. But then we encounter this Jamil who now is aware of the world in some instances as a teenager and is now aware that they have feelings for people that they are not, in air quotes, supposed to have feelings for. And they go to madrasa, and when they get there, it's, you know, it's told this is wrong. And so in many instances, it reminds us of how you want to be good, right? You want to not let your parents down. You don't want to let Allah down. You don't want to let God down. So you're just like, I want to deny these things. Like, they're not good for me. And then there is also a settling and a becoming, you know, a hold up. This is me. This has to be me, right? These feelings are not going away. I've prayed them away and they're not going away. So that means that they are okay.
Yeah.
And I want to talk a little bit about that, right? About just like how odious this journey of becoming can be and how absolutely taxing it is to become by yourself, because in many instances, you don't want to let down the people that love you. You know, I think about the relationship with your mom and how in many instances, becoming queer is like a betrayal to, you know, often our parents say, did I raise my child well? Am I at fault? And so you also don't want to play into that. But at the same time, there's a deep denial to yourself.
Yeah. Very difficult thing to do, to deal with, to live with. And yeah, like, you know, for me, I also mentioned in the book that there was a point at which I seriously considered what the possibilities for my life are. And there were three. The one was claim what I understood or how I constructed asexuality to myself at the time, just meaning I don't have any kind of sexual feelings, hence I won't be, quote unquote, attracted to anyone. That was my understanding at the time, right? Because also I don't think I had imagined at the I didn't imagine at the time that that my sexuality could have anything else to do, could have to do with anything else other than sex. And so that was how I could explain it away. The other was actually just to submit to unhappiness and do what was expected of me. And yeah, just sacrifice every last kind of individuality, authenticity, and happiness. And then the other option, of course, was to die. That was how I saw it. Because there was just no way that I could live in this society as me and who I want to be. But I think, you know, there's something to be said for holding on. And I say that I don't say it lightly, you know, because I do believe that for some people, it's not an option. For some people, it is not fair to tell them to hold on when they no longer want to. But for as long as what there is, for as long as what there's a possibility, for as long as what there is a, you know, something else that can be imagined. And that imagination in itself is a queerness. For as long as what there is, that is some, it's worth holding on for, because with every new step in the journey of becoming, and then in some ways unbecoming, with every new step, things seemed a little bit more bearable, and a different kind of life seemed a little bit more attainable. And that happened extremely incrementally for me. But it sounds really, really cliche, but I suppose you can't do one of these podcasts without making a cliche, because that's just how the world works. But one step at a time, truly. Truly one step at a time. And sometimes, you know, sometimes you sit down in the middle of the road and the cars are whizzing past you and you almost get hit 20 times because you on that day, you're not going to take another step. You can't take another step. But there really is, yeah, I mean, there really is something to be said for. If it seems worth your while, then it's worth just imagining that there could be a different way. And so for me, that was generally how my becoming unfolded. And so with each new realization and each new possibility that you imagine, you then sort of close the door on the previous realities that have governed your life, your lived experience. Yeah.
Rich. Bars on bars on bars being dropped in this podcast today. So many crucibles. I wanted to go back a little bit in the book, and I think that there was an important reflection that took place. And I think of your time at school. And I think for many of us, our time at school is a time of trauma, right? Because it's where we first learn the violence of assimilation, but also the performance of goodness, right? So the performance of being good because you look a particular way and there are particular things that are associated with how you look that you don't want to have associated with you. But also that you begin to learn very early that excellence in many ways is the way that you survive, right? So excellence is a survival method. And I want to talk a little bit about that, right? So this performance of goodness that I think Black people are perpetually trapped in because of the anti-Blackness that's around us. But also just to think of something that Tlhokonolo always speaks about, and that is excellence as survival for queer people. And I'm hoping that we can just have some reflections on that, because those are some important things that I think came through in the book and that are a reflection for many of us reading the book.
Yeah, you know, I often say, I am absolutely here for the movement of Black mediocrity. Black people must be rewarded for their mediocrity, Shane, because the scales must be balanced at some point. But with that said, it's an interesting thing, right, that's also the way in which or gateway to which we can have worthiness attached to us, because we are excellent. Because we've, so now, Alma gets like, you know, sort of, she's a middle of the road kind of person, and doesn't get the 80s and 90% that I get. But therefore, Alma must now be treated with disrespect. And Alma is also, she's up for being harmed and she's up for being insulted. And yeah, we can say and do whatever we want to Alma because she's mediocre. And I think the conversation comes down to the danger of the meanings attached to things like excellence and mediocrity for Black people, right? Because everything under these circumstances then come down to, well, what is your human value? You know, and what are the kinds of things that you deserve out of life based on how you perform? And in many ways, so we're talking about school, right? But school was a dress rehearsal for performing for capitalism one day. And at the time, the consequences for me were not necessarily that dire if I wasn't excellent, right? Because my parents were in charge of our lives. But then you get older and then you become in charge. And then this dichotomy between mediocrity and excellence that then also is linked to inferiority, superiority as a human being, as material consequences for your life. And I struggle, you know, I struggle with, I've seen it said many times, you know, that excellence and sort of constantly wanting to be the best and first in these things. As much as what you would frame it for yourself as just, you know, it's fulfilling and I enjoy it. I really struggle with the realization that it's a trauma response. And also I wonder then, what am I supposed to do with that? How does one resolve that kind of trauma? Because the way I read it is, if constant, unrelenting excellence is a trauma response, then resolving the trauma response is to stop being unrelentingly excellent. And I can't see that that's a possibility for my life, you know. So it's a very difficult thing to think about how to resolve, because like I just said, not doing that has material consequences for your life. And I think it's just a really extremely unfair and burdensome expectation to put on people, and particularly in a not only a country, but in a world whereby this is actually not the standard for everyone. This is a standard for a select few people who themselves have already been made vulnerable by the systems that govern them. And then to still pile on top of that more responsibility to survive the system. It's a very difficult conversation to have. And I do see it. I do see how it's a trauma response, but I struggle very much with what to do with that realization.
I think additionally to that, for me, have also been questions about the ways in which that frames how people see our humanity, right? So this unrelenting quest for excellence often means that we are not granted opportunities to be human. And so to do things that humans do, like to make mistakes, to make bad judgment calls, to have a bad day. Sometimes it goes down to a simple thing like having a bad day. And there are things about constantly being denied your humanity, or constantly having to prove your humanity through excellence, you know? And for me, that is a greater part of the question. What does this mean for my humanity if I'm on an unrelenting quest to be excellent in a world that will never recognize what it means to be Black and queer, or Black women, and all these other identities that people hold? And so the question about humanity is a big one for me, because what does it mean in the face of all of these anti-Black structures to constantly navigate excellence, right? And to constantly counter that for people who don't see your humanity.
Yeah. It becomes an unattainable ideal, you know? Because if the ideal with excellence is to establish and affirm a humanity that is being denied of you. But you can never fully attain, or you can never fully assert that excellence, because it's never enough. It's never good enough either, you know, and once you've proven that you can do it once, you have to keep on doing it. That is then a statement of how unattainable this humanity becomes. I almost don't know what to do with that, because it becomes such a seemingly hopeless situation. But when I do feel like that, I often go back to James Baldwin, who said that he can't give up. He can't stop believing that things will change, because then he's decided that being human is an academic matter, and he can't allow himself to be handed over to such cynicism. So I don't know. It sounds trite, but there must be an end in sight, and maybe I'm saying that to self-soothe. But yes, I do agree with you that it becomes a very big question about then how unattainable humanity becomes when you can never, there's never an end to how much you have to prove this excellence that will entitle you to a particular kind of humanity.
I mean, I love that you speak about Baldwin, because, you know, Baldwin's my fave. And he says, I have to be an optimist, right? That's literally what he says. He says, I have to be an optimist. Yeah. And I mean, connected with this idea of excellence and survival, particularly for queer people and for marginalized bodies, is also this idea of like performance in order to be loved. So many of us have been excellent because we want to be loved. And we believe that if we are not excellent, people won't love us, right? Mm-hmm. And that's been something that I've been grappling a lot with, right? Like Toni Morrison often says, you're not the work that you do, you are who you are. Mm-hmm. But who am I, right, in a world that seeks to, like, literally strip me of my humanity? What is my worthiness if my worthiness has not been constructed in the way that the world has constructed my worthiness? You're this excellent, articulate person, and now that has become an integral part of who I believe myself to be, right? So how do we, as you say, how do we deal with this trauma response? Because in many ways, dealing with this trauma response is, I think, confronting ourselves head on. And are we even ready to confront ourselves head on?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and this comes back to a previous conversation we had during this podcast, and that was chosen families. There are some things that are just, like I said, unrelenting. And in some ways, it's almost like it's unattainable. But I think it becomes then very important for you to create and to nurture spaces in which you can just be, because you might not be able to do that within the structure of the world at large always, but you can create microcosms of rest and of softness and kindness, that where your humanity is fully recognized, where there are no question marks above your head about who you are and what you do and what you have to do in order to receive love. I have done a lot of that throughout my life. The performance, it's been, yes, it's exactly that. It's been survival. I found myself in many situations whereby my comfort depends on how well I perform this. And in some ways it just became a natural response to the environment. But what I've done with that is that I have removed myself from those environments, and I've inserted myself in environments that don't require that of me. And so in relation to what you're saying, I think it makes such a strong case for the need to create and chosen families, and to create environments and communities of care for each other. And whatever that looks like, you know, whatever that looks like, if we cannot find any rest in the world, we can at least find it for moments in time. Who was it that said something about I can't give no peace because I can't get no peace, something to that effect. but we can find some peace. We can try. We certainly can try. And I think that's what it comes down to, trying. So that optimism that Baldwin spoke about, that's also a statement about trying, you know, and trying again. And my other own girl, Maya, who said, trust love, or have the courage to trust love one more time and always one more time. And I think that can be extended beyond the concept of just romantic love or even platonic love or love itself. For me, it becomes really a sort of a mantra by which to live. And it speaks to just giving it another chance, trying again, which reminds me again of, I think, something that's built into the statement that my grandfather made, which was, and I'll say it in the way that he said it, was, "Jes nooit te sleg om goed te raak en jes nooit te goed om sleg te raak." And that was speaking to the infinite possibilities for human error, but also the wonder of human beings. And within that, in order to adopt something like that, you have to be willing to try and try again.
That's absolutely powerful. And I think such a beautiful note to end on is the idea that you try and try again in the midst of what seems to be these exhaustive list of cannot or why not. But I think that it's beautiful to end on such a powerful note. Before we go, what's next for Jamil? What's happening? What can we expect from you? And now that the book is out, how do you feel about the fact that the book is out? What are your reflections on being a publisher?
And also the long listing. Congratulations.
Yes.
Thank you. And also to mention, I do want to mention, I'm very, very excited about the fact that the Gauteng Department of Sports, Arts and Culture have agreed to take 110 copies of the book to distribute across libraries in Gauteng, public libraries. I think it's a very, it's very affirming, number one, but also it just makes me so happy because I think that's the ultimate destination of a book. And I have to say this, when I've had to think about why I do what I do many times. And the answer that I give myself has changed many times. But the one thing that has not changed is realizing that I want to create an archive of experiences of people like me. I want for when I am no longer here, for there to be a record of people to say, you know, there was this person and they said these things. And I think it's interesting. And I think it's useful. And more so, I think it provides evidence for the things that we are still now disputing and having sort of conversations about. And I think for the book to end up in a public library is the ultimate affirmation of that endeavor to create an archive of experience that can be later discovered. But what next? there is book number two in discussion. My publisher is pushing that button, and I'm just like, child, give me a break. But no, it's there. Some other publications. I've already written them. They are in the works to be published this year. That give insights into other parts of my life historically, but also in the now. And I think they will be very interesting sort of additions or addendums to the story, which, by the way, the feedback that I often received was, people say, I wish it didn't end. I wanted it to go on and on and on. It will go on, and it will not go on in the form of this physical book here, but there will be other installments that sort of continue to tell the story. Couple of publications, a second book in the works, and there is another book project that I'm working on, which I will reveal in time. But there are those things that are happening. And then, of course, I need to finish my PhD. But that's it. That's it in a nutshell.
I mean, Jamil, thank you so much for spending this morning talking to us about your book and just some reflections on the book. We really appreciate it. But more importantly, thank you for being so vulnerable to share yourself in ways that you have. And now the book is out of your hands and, you know, people will receive it the way that they want to receive it. But from the Cheeky Natives, we thank you. And we look forward to book number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 10.
Yeah.
And we look forward to constantly being a home where you feel comfortable to come and sit and reflect and heal with us. We wish you the very best. And we say again, congratulations for the long list. Hopefully it will be a short list. And then ultimately we're going to be like award-winning author.
Yes.
So with that, again, we encourage you Cheeky Natives to come out and buy Khamer. And, you know, the Cheeky Merchant is your plug because we will give you personally signed copies of the book by Jamil, and it will be delivered to your door. So if you really enjoyed this conversation and you really just want to support the author, just head over to our website, www.cheekynatives.co.za/shop, and look for Khamer. Press the add to cart and purchase, and we will deliver to you. Until next time, Cheeky Natives, goodbye.
Bye. Bye-bye.